Hello, and welcome to Speaking Volumes. We're the radio book group for everyone who enjoys reading and talking about books. We are a production of Audio Journal. This program is funded in part by the Greater Worcester Community Foundation and by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind. If you're joining us for the first time, welcome, and if you're one of our regular members, welcome back. Audio Journal is a radio reading service intended for a print-impaired audience. Material is selected with the interests of its audience in mind and with the goals of informing and entertaining. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinion of Audio Journal, its board of directors, or staff. The opinions are ours alone. There are three of us gathered around the table in the studio tonight. I'd like to welcome Tricia Droney, Carla McCullough, and my name is Carol Sarafkhan. Our book tonight is Everything in Its Place, First Loves and Last Tales by Oliver Sacks. We hope you'll join the conversation, too. The phone number to call is 508-373-2343. I'll repeat that again, 508-373-2343. Feel free to jump in with a phone call at any time. And we're happy to welcome Steve Robsky. So there are four of us in the studio tonight. I've asked Carla to give us a summary of the book to get us started. So let's go there first. Carla?
Indeed. Everything in Its Place, First Loves and Last Tales by Oliver Sacks. A final volume of essays that showcase Oliver Sacks's broad range of interests, from his passion for ferns, swimming, and horsetails, to his final case histories exploring schizophrenia, dementia, and Alzheimer's. Oliver Sacks, renowned scientist and storyteller, is adored by readers for his neurological case histories, his fascination and familiarity with human behavior at its most unexpected and unfamiliar. Published posthumously in 2019, Everything in Its Place is a celebration of Sacks's myriad interests, all told with his characteristic compassion, erudition, and luminous prose. From the celebrated case history of Spalding Gray that appeared in The New Yorker 4 months before his death, to reflections on mental asylums, from piercing accounts of schizophrenia to a reminiscence of Robin Williams, from the riveting tale of a medical colleague falling victim to Alzheimer's to the healing power of gardens, and from a critique of social media to the threat of climate change, this volume celebrates and reflects the wondrous curiosity of Oliver Sacks.
Thanks, Carla. This certainly was a broad range of topics covered in this book. I knew about Oliver Sacks from his writing about neurological things, but I had no idea of the breadth of his knowledge and interests, and it was a little disjointed, I guess you could say. I mean, you're reading about ferns one minute and schizophrenia the next, but still, it was a great introduction to the man. What did you think about it, Tricia?
Well, this is my kind of book. I really loved it. And I also had the experience of I was on a long drive, and so, listening to it on with a wonderful reader. And, you know, just as an aside, I do think that is a really different experience. And it sort of, to me, it sort of, especially on a reasonable drive, it's not two-handed. It just sort of hits in a different way, you know, when you have a wonderful reader. So that's an aside. But, above anything else, to me, it just stood out as an amazing storyteller, and then was just riveting. I was interested, other than one chapter about protons, you know, I was all in and just curious. I was wondering, where is he going? And so just from that standpoint alone, it truly was a page turner or a chapter turner as I was driving down the highway. So that's my overall review.
Thanks. What did you think, Steve?
Well, the opening with the British Museums, When I was a high school senior, my biology teacher took the class to the Museum of Natural History in New York City on a Saturday. We were given little worksheets as to things to find out. I got there, and I dropped the worksheet. I just could not help but wandering the Museum of Natural History for hours. There was a girl in the class who was not particularly friendly, but I put myself prostrate before her and said, "Can I copy your answers?" And I spent the day just wandering the Museum of Natural History. And, I mean, what can I say? It's a kinship and a brothership with him. I still go back there as often as I can get my kids or grandkids or whatever to do it. It's a wonderful thing, just the love of the museum. Davies, of course, actually he set me up for something that I was hoping for that didn't quite happen. Davies didn't. Sachs did, of course. His description of Davies formalizing chemistry and going from the four elements, fire, air, wind, earth, and water, to what chemistry really is. And I was kind of hoping he was going to do the same thing with neurology and psychiatry, and he didn't. So it left me a little disappointed in that regard.
It's probably in another one of his books.
Well, the other thing is his writing and all reminded me very much of a college professor I had that I did not like. Kind of pompous and self-aggrandizing. And I got that same sense reading his stuff, and I was trying hard not to think of Dr. Silver, who I'm sure has passed by now, while reading it. But there was always something that annoyed me slightly about the way he writes.
Carla?
He doesn't annoy me. I love him so very much. I love Dr. Sachs. I love his writing style. I find him endlessly curious and also compassionate to his patients. I do think that he writes scholarly, but also accessibly. I think the layperson can appreciate the mysteries of the mind in the human psyche, but it also is challenging. There's certainly plenty of times where I'm looking up conditions and it leads me to other rabbit holes, but I'm a big fan. Oliver Sacks is one of my very favorite authors, and I've read at least 8 of his other books, and they always please me. I enjoy his writing very much.
Did you have a particular chapter in here, Carla, that you wanted to talk about? We've all got favorites, I'm sure, but
I loved all the case studies. I work with the adult neurogenic population, so those speak to me because I can relate to things that I've seen in the past. I liked the story of Uncle Toby. This was not something that I've dealt with on a personal level working with someone, but what a story. I'll remind folks what this one was about. This poor man just gradually over time fell into this illness. He was suspended in some strange icy stupor is what they wrote. They measured his temperature. They needed special equipment. His temperature was so low. He had a 68-degree temperature. In his family, it happened so gradually that they just took it as like, oh, he just doesn't feel well, and they took care of him, but did not bother to look into what was causing this gradual decline into really just mummified state. And when Oliver Sacks got involved with his care, they slowly warmed him up and he came back to life. And he thought that only a couple of weeks had gone by when it had literally been 7 years. However, the ultimate irony is once they warmed him up and he was feeling well, he had had cancer in his system that had also been dormant. So they saved his life by ignoring this illness. And then once they warmed him up and he came back to life, the cancer killed him within days.
Yes.
Truth is truly stranger than fiction. That is a crazy story. So, Uncle Toby, that story, talk about a page-turner and suspenseful read. That was
amazing. Yes. And you wonder, I mean, I know they said it happened so gradually, the family got used to it, but you would think just touching his hand, you would notice how cool it was, mm-hmm. you know. Oh, my goodness. But it, strange but true. How about you, Tricia? Do you have anything favorites?
Well, one that really stood out was the story about Spalding Gray. Mm-hmm. And I had the good fortune to see him live years ago. And, you know, talk about a storyteller meeting a storyteller, because as he describes, you know, it's a stage with one man, a table, maybe some water, and a microphone. But when you left one of his performances, which is stories that he mm-hmm. told, you felt like you had gone to those places. That's how riveting it was. And the characters stay in your head. It was just that remarkable. So, you know, I was a big fan of his and followed him. But one of the things I loved was learning about what had actually happened to him. And it was a good reminder to me of, you know, we read these headlines and there's always these huge stories behind the headline. That's what it felt like reading that, because I knew of what happened to him, but I had no idea of why that happened. You know, when you meet him, it's like he's a Robin Williams kind of huge, like, you know, life force. So the idea that he died by suicide was less shocking because of this huge, huge, huge persona that he had. But, you know, I don't know that was not fully described, or the agony he went through and all of the things he tried to do and his family tried to do. And in his case, it did seem they were making a case for some of what was happening to him, in addition to the accident that he had, which really started all of these neurological problems, was that there was this really deep history in him of his mother and water. And, you know, it was just so it just was this tale that was sad, and you just watch somebody do everything in their power, and he was so beloved and he wanted to live, but he blah, blah, blah. And that even with, you know, all kinds of interventions, you know, he was at peace when he died. I mean, that's the comfort that you could find. And it did seem like Oliver Sacks also was friendly with him, in addition to as a you know, one of the many people that was involved. But again, to me, it's just this reminder. It's like, you know, there's always more than we know that goes on. And so I appreciate it, again, having been such an admirer of his work.
And I think that's something you point to, is that Oliver Sacks' sympathy for his patients comes through, you know, that it's we don't see a distance between patient and doctor in when he describes these case studies. He seems to really care about the people he's describing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Steve, what's got your attention in this book?
That's a good question. We want to think of our bodies. This is me as a engineer, of course, as being machines. As you put input in, so it gets processed, and output comes out. And it's a rational thing that happens. And quite clearly, it isn't quite that simple.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, his descriptions of the neurological problems. And Uncle Toby, of course, is a great example of the system just not working, and somehow all of it stops working.
Mm.
And, I mean, I get deep into thought about what is intelligent life and all of that type of thing. I don't go to sleep easily at night. I have a virtual nephew, long, long family story, who was a colonel in the Army, and he asked me if I thought there was other life in the world, universe. I said, of course, but is there intelligent life? And he looked back at me and said, well, mean on Earth? I said, well, that's a good question. But if you stop to think about the arithmetic, the Earth is about 5 billion years old. There's been on Earth about, how do we define intelligence? Well, say symbolic language. Can I express to somebody an idea without pointing to the actual thing? Hmm. We've been able to do that for about 100,000 years, it appears. So of the 5 billion years in Earth history, we've had 100,000 years of intelligent life on Earth, which is a 1 in 50,000 chance that anybody who ever came to visit us would have found intelligent life. And it just kind of, what does this all mean? What's going on in our heads? What makes us? Why are we intelligent or not, as the case may be? So anyway, yeah, there's lots of brain fuzzing going on in this book for me.
Yeah.
Right.
I was particularly struck by the chapter about Tourette's. Travels with Lowell. Just to remind our listeners, this was Lowell is a has Tourette's himself, but he's a photographer, and he wanted to try to take pictures of other Tourette's when they were ticking to see if he could capture it in photography. And so he and Oliver Sacks, he had made contact with people with Tourette's all over the country and in through Canada. And so he and Oliver Sacks went on a trip to visit all these different people. And it gave Sacks the opportunity to see more people with Tourette's than he would ever have had in a clinical practice, just waiting for them to come to him. And it was particularly fascinating that Lowell had found this Mennonite community way up in northern Canada where Tourette's was very common. You got the impression that maybe 50% of the people in the town had Tourette's. He didn't give us numbers, but as the people there talked about, well, my aunt and my sister and my brother and, you know, at all these different relatives. And this chapter led me to track down a story that I had heard. My daughter went to college with someone with Tourette's, and the first day of class, the professor said, this man, I forget his name, wants to make an announcement before I start class. So he stood up and he explained, I have Tourette's and I have, you know, uncontrolled movements, but also I have a verbal tic, and it sounds just like a Cocker Spaniel puppy barking. And that's when it started, when my family got a Cocker Spaniel puppy when I was a little boy. And so my daughter knew him from class. And then later she stayed to work a summer job on the maintenance crew at the college. And he did, too. And they were on the same maintenance crew at the college. So she got to work with him a little bit more there. And she learned that she said that the closest comparison of a tic is a sneeze. You can stop yourself from sneezing, but you tense everything up to do it. And sometimes when ticking was really, when it was a social situation that was very difficult for this young man, he would try to suppress his tics to the point that he was getting cervical fractures because his muscles were tensing so hard. The bones were actually breaking. And finally, his doctor said to him, you can't suppress these. You can't do this to yourself. You have to allow yourself to tic. But there's one nice story that my daughter heard that summer. This man and his girlfriend very rarely went out to eat because, as you can imagine, this is problematic. But they did one time go to Applebee's, and he started ticking and barking, and other customers were looking at him. I don't know if they were complaining to management, but it just happened that day the regional manager was visiting that Applebee's, and he went over to the table and he said, you can't control that, can you? And he said, no, I can't. And he said, I just want you to know you are always welcome at Applebee's. Mm. And that's why my daughter eats at Applebee's. and why.
For
it
life.
Was one of the, yeah, really. Yeah, it was just such a kind thing to say. But
and that's why education is important, too, because I think that people, if they know more, if they have that health literacy, then perhaps they'll be more open and accepting and just, oh, okay, this is beyond someone's control, instead of being irritated by a disturbance. Yeah.
The other thing I learned is that the movies usually get it wrong. When Tourette's is in a movie, it's usually swear words.
Mm-hmm.
And Oliver Sacks does refer to that, but actually, of the Tourette's population, that's a very small minority of the population that has that particular coprolalia.
Mm, nice word choice, coprolalia.
I learned that. I learned that for you.
I would have said dirty mouth.
So that was one chapter that particularly touched me because it reminded me of those stories.
Well, that was actually in the news very recently. The movie Sinners, and I think it was at the BAFTA Awards, but one of the other, not mm-hmm. Oscar, won for Best Movie. And the director and the Michael B. Jordan was the main character. He played two characters. And the director, Ryan Coogler, I think. So they're get up, and they are at getting their award. It's really big. And someone with Tourette's was in the audience and yelled out a racial epithet. Mm. And it was a big deal, you can imagine. But the story did not, it sort of got tamped down because the person said, explained what was happening, and this is a, you know, and they were so gracious. And, you know, because this was their moment, I just got to emphasize that, you know, and it just got tamped down, you know, because of that. So I think we all sort of learned something mm-hmm. in that. But, Carol, that part where he went to Canada
mm-hmm.
and that whole community was just blew me away. Mm-hmm. And it also just sort of brings to light that in that community, it was normalized. Mm-hmm. You know, that wasn't even, nobody paid, didn't pay attention to it. It wasn't even aberrant because there was enough numbers of people who experienced that. And so they were interacting all of the time. And it just sort of, you sort of step out of that and you go, well, what does it take besides education? It's mm-hmm. going to be the key thing. When we see and experience differences in people, of how we can how we can get better at accepting that and not having it all be other. I'm normal, you're other. You know, just this whole idea about normal is questionable, really. Mm-hmm. But it's just, you know, that's one neurological issue, but there's with so many others. It's the same with you know, we experience many people who have dementia or Alzheimer's. It's so frightening to people to interact with people who have dementia, mm-hmm. even though those numbers are growing, you know, mm-hmm. exponentially and everything else. But sort of just that question of why do we keep doing that? Because it's scary. It's mm-hmm. different. I don't know what to do here. But then, you know, it's just, I don't know. It's a good, there's a lesson in there.
Yeah. I think so. I think one way we're making a little progress is starting to look at things as spectrums.
Mm-hmm.
And that's already a big breakthrough, I think, that we're realizing that there are degrees of these things. And there are lots of places to be along, but it's all a spectrum.
Absolutely. Black and white thinking just doesn't serve. Everything is on a gradient for sure. This whole page of notes was on that Travels with Lowell chapter because I also thought that was fascinating. There was a Carla with a K who was a twin, Toretter. And I thought I was laughing so hard because her and her twin sister
one would be yelling, take a right, and the other would be saying, take a left, while he was driving. And I'm crying laughing reading this, and this is a true story. They would clear movie theaters yelling, fire, and at the beach they were yelling, shark, and they didn't mean it. It was just those compulsives that they could not contain, but just to see Carla
which,
with a K.
Which points out, again, why it's so hard to go out.
Oh, yeah.
To right. Or to the movie theater. And apparently even to the beach.
That one, I was laughing. And I have a couple of experiences personally with some Tourette's folks. I had done some exercising with a guy who had Tourette's, and his were physical tics. And he would just open his mouth and stick his tongue all the way out like Gene Simmons in Kiss, if you get that reference. But mm-hmm. At first I wasn't sure what that was all about. And I said, oh, okay, he must have Tourette's. And my very favorite cousin, Tony, is mentally handicapped. And Tourette's, or those tics, is just one of a lot of disabilities that he has. But unfortunately, his word that is that N-word that he will say under his breath all the time. And it made it to the point where we couldn't take him out to restaurants with us anymore, which was his only, like, joy was going out to eat. But we were going to get killed because he didn't physically look handicapped. Mm-hmm. But he was very much mentally handicapped, and he just would repeat that word under his breath. And if he got upset or impatient, he would start, like, smacking and saying. Mm. And I said, I would take any other word but that word.
I wonder if – I've wondered about that with the patients who have Tourette's. I just were like, oh, can I just have a different word? Or I don't want to bark. I want – you know, if and they can't redirect, obviously, but you could imagine the pain about what you were given, mm-hmm. you know, in this. And but also to your point, Steve, about the, it's just the how delicate our systems are was really came across in this book. You know, like I don't remember or recall what exactly is going on when you have Tourette's, but there is a part of the brain. There's a part of the brain that for some reason in that person, you know, but it just feels like that's one thing for people who have Tourette's. I just feel like we're all, you know, a bump on the head away from some kind of different response of relating to the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the interesting stories was the woman who couldn't read her watch any longer. Mm-hmm. And the question is, can you adopt? Can you do it a different way, which, of course, you figured out how to do with a digital watch. But can I actually, I was a computer guy, so there, computers have different instruction sets. Different
Excuse
computers.
Me, Steve.
Yes.
Hello, this is Speaking Volumes. You're on the air. Who's calling, please?
Hi, Carol. This is Rachel calling from Medway, Massachusetts.
Oh, hi, Rachel. Nice to hear from you. I know you're a regular listener. What do you think about this book by Oliver Sacks?
I found the book to be really good, especially because, the story you were just telling about the Tourette's syndrome, I had a friend that actually had it when she went to school with me, and some of us laughed at her, like not meaning to know that the Tourette's syndrome existed, but now I feel bad.
Yeah, it must be difficult for people to have to be misunderstood or have to be explaining themselves all the time.
I agree with you, like 100%. But I really enjoyed the book. There was not one part that I hated.
That's
great. I really liked the book all the way through, and I'd recommend it to anyone.
That's great. Mm. Maybe like Carla, you'll end up reading 8 of his books. Because he has written a lot of books.
I have read 5 of them.
Oh, have you?
Oh, okay. Big fan.
Oh, we've got another sax fan here.
We'll call ourselves the saxophones or something.
There you go. Oh, I love it. And she's on the phone. That's perfect.
Rachel, one of the chapters that I was interested in was about the mental health asylums and how we've closed all the long-term mental health societies and put people out in the community and seem to have created a homeless population that we didn't have before. Do you remember that chapter, Rachel?
I do remember it, yes.
That asylum, the word means like refuge, protection, and it was a it was from a very paternalistic way of thinking, you know, that, well, paternalistic was only part of what went into it. I think it was also
loving,
hiding people away. Huh?
Loving right. and accommodating.
Yes.
Yes.
Loving and accommodating and keeping it out of our way or something mm-hmm. like that, you know, protecting from families. But I remember this time when the hospitals were closing. I did an internship at Worcester State Hospital when, you know, the population had gotten smaller and smaller and smaller, but I was interning on a unit of mm-hmm. dually diagnosed people who were mentally challenged and mentally ill and mm-hmm. developmentally delayed. Those are the two words I want to combine. And it was hard to find placements for these people. They, you know, one by one, they were trying to find placements, but it is not easy. They had lived their whole lives.
Oh, that's too bad. Yeah. That's way too bad. Wow.
Yeah, it is hard. They wow. were, I mean, you can look at it as they were incarcerated, but they were also taken care of and fed and helped and you know, all through everyday day life. And the idea that they were going to go to a lesser environment seemed difficult. They had a learned helplessness.
Mm-hmm. Right.
After all those years. Yeah. Well, Rachel, I'm so glad you called, and I hope you'll like our next book, too. I think it's one that you recommended, Fried Green Tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe.
Yep, that was me.
Good. All right. Well, we'll look forward to hearing from you again next month. I hope you'll call again.
Oh, I definitely will. Love you guys, and God bless you all.
Okay. Thank you, Rachel.
Bye, Rachel.
Goodbye.
Steve, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I was so glad to see the phone light up there that I wanted to get to it.
Of course, as was I. The idea that looking at the human as a mechanical item appeals to me somehow. Mm. The real question is, I'm looking at Tricia here, a very lovely lady, for those of you who can't see her. Can I express a thought? I have many thoughts in my head. Is there any way I can transfer a thought from my brain to Tricia's mm-hmm. without using some intermediate language? We both speak English, so I can describe a green meadow with little yellow buttercups or something, and she will get that picture, but is she truly getting what I'm seeing? Mm-hmm. What are the limits of our communication? You know, we hear this idea of an image being burned in our brain, something mm-hmm. that happened, you know, it was traumatic, and there never is an image in your brain. Everything in your brain about imaging is referential. No place is there, you know, this idea of a photographic negative being taken from your eyes. There aren't enough optic nerves to do that. Mm-hmm. Everything is a scan and a note. You look and see a baseball. Then your next scan, you see the baseball in a slightly different place. But you don't really see the baseball at all. You're just seeing this object. And this is how they do a lot of the video compression for our movies. Our CD movies and streaming services. There's never really an image mm-hmm. that you start with. Are there ideas? For a while, when I was working with computers, I was involved in projects to move software from one machine to another without having to go back to the source code. And I can take, you know, an IBM instruction set and convert it to a Motorola instruction set. But they're not exactly the same. And can I actually make that program run on a different computer without going back to the English language or whatever language, most of it is English, source code? And it's very, very difficult.
Hmm.
One of the things that most people don't realize, tell me to shut up, please, at some point, is that when you look at television, you're actually seeing two separate pictures at once. It scans every all other line. So your eye essentially anything over like 20 hertz, your eye will blend together. That's mm-hmm. the whole idea of movies. But really, you couldn't get 20 hertz in the early days of television. So you had 15 hertz, and you were just seeing half of the picture at a time. You'd see all the odd number lines being scanned across the TV. Then you would see the even numbered lines. and they were time displaced. And a serious question is, how do you go? Everything now is progressive scanned on television, where it just goes right down the whole picture. But how do you go from the now I just lost it, the interlaced to progressive scan? The picture's taken at different times. And anyway, I'm going off geeky here. I'm very sorry, but just the idea of how the brain works is something that I can't fathom, and I really feel bad for that. I figure like I should understand what the brain is doing, and it does. I don't.
I don't think science understands it.
Exactly.
Well,
yes.
I mean,
the final
whole,
frontier.
The whole world of science doesn't. They know pieces, and they're as fascinated as we are.
Yeah, certainly Oliver Sacks is fascinated with all of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You started, Steve, that conversation regarding this woman who was looking at a clock and couldn't see it. And I wanted to jump on that because just a small little chapter was talking about nothing, where he introduced folks under anesthesia and with other neurological impacts that affected someone's own self-perception. He introduced the concept of neglect and agnosia. So I brought in something, my very favorite example of a visual neglect. Carol and I, you've worked with some folks before with neurological deficits. So one of my favorite little tasks to have patients do is a clock drawing. And this is really common that doctors and neurologists will have patients draw a clock, make the circle, put in all the numbers of the clock, then set the hands for 10 minutes after 11. And it's really common because we are getting written language, planning, right, left, visual scanning, abstract
spatial organization.
Spatial organization, abstract thought, that too represents 10 minutes after. So my favorite example was a woman who had left neglect, and I'm going to describe this to our listeners over here. I asked this patient, who was an artist, actually, to draw the face of a clock, put in all the numbers of that clock. And so, listener, what I am looking at is truly a face, but only half of a face. All the numbers are only on the right side. There's poor planning in that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 are only in that upper right-hand quadrant. I'm seeing only one eye, a nose, one ear with an earring. And the left side just doesn't exist. The circle was there, but there's no numbers on that side. There's no eye or ear on that side. And yet I think this picture is fascinating.
Oh, I
absolutely love it. And this is truly someone with left neglect. But there is artistic flair in abundance in this picture. And it's just one of my favorite examples. And it's just how fascinating the mind is. And, you know, what can happen? And again, I've said it again, the truth is stranger than fiction. Like, what is she thinking? And I've seen folks who they were worried about their intake. Oh, no, they're not eating. Well, because they were only eating half of their plate. We would have to train them. Okay, turn that plate counterclockwise. They're ready to, like, put a PEG tube or IV in someone. I'm like, no. Just move it on the side of the plate that they can see. So, again, treating the patient as a whole, understanding their deficits so they can better accommodate. Just interesting stuff.
So, Carla, the woman who did that drawing, how did she present clinically?
Like, she presented without awareness of her difficulties. So she was a right stroke. So she had a left neglect. If you were on her left side, she did not know you were there.
Mm-hmm.
She would not dress that side of her body. She would not comb that side of her hair. It was, she would need those visual cues. Okay, now look, turn your head more. And it literally would need to be turning your whole body in order to see things. Or so we would, you know, put the TV on that side, forcing looking over on that side just to pay attention.
Mm.
And what's really difficult if someone doesn't have awareness. And that's the agnosia part, is decreased awareness. So if you think, well, it's not my problem, it's your problem, there's nothing wrong with me, that's challenging to work when someone doesn't have awareness of their difficulties. And I believe another, like coprolalia is Carol's 10-cent word, an anosognosia. Anosognosia is that decreased awareness of deficits. And that's a challenge.
And you walk into doorways.
I bet you do.
Yeah, because you don't see anything. And I had one of my favorite stories about someone with left neglect and left unaware of their left body is discovering that there was an arm next to them and screaming, "There's a man in my bed." Because they discovered their own limb and mistook it for somebody else must have gotten into bed with me. Yeah, it's weird. But
But
a lot of these people can get better. You know, this happens after an acute stroke, and, you know, therapists do their work, and people improve and get better.
Healing
and they
curse.
learn compensations, and the brain learns compensations. The brain rewires itself, Steve. You would appreciate this.
Oh, yes.
There's a lot of plasticity to the brain, and so people do recover from this.
One of my last programs was working with a computer that changed its own instruction set. That could change its own instruction set. So it would. This was actually the singularity, because it could write a program that would modify itself to get better and better and better. And I had one demo for it, and it just scared people to show them. You know, this is a singularity in the Terminator movies, I guess. All of a sudden, machines can make better machines than we can. But there's also the idea of a combination or compensation. And without going too deeply, I have a granddaughter who is on the spectrum of autism. And the question that always occurs to me is, when is she being a brat and when is she being limited? I mean, I certainly want to accommodate her in any way, but you need to accommodate. Okay, at some point I know that I can't focus intently on this or whatever. Don't do that. But how do you teach that to a 12-year-old? And I don't know.
It's
I love the
challenge.
Little girl. I like to hug her a lot. And generally, if I hug her, everything's okay. But
yeah, it's a challenge. What did you think about Oliver Sacks' thoughts about libraries? And, you know, his image of a library is almost an old world library, you know, with towering shelves of books and big tables where he would sit for a whole day working on something. And he finds that that people don't browse in libraries anymore, and libraries are really cutting back on their collections and digitizing lots of things. And is this, have we lost something, or are we gaining something with all this digitization?
I would say both. I used to love to go into bookstores and just kind of walk down, and if there's an author I recognize, oh, I haven't read this, or there's a book next to that that I haven't read. Again, turning geeky, for years, whenever I went to a used bookstore, I'd buy calculus books. Because calculus is one of those ideas that nobody quite gets. And different calculus books teach it differently. The analogies, the metaphors are different. I mean, I'm, of course, a pure mathematician, and I understand calculus perfectly. But there's people can't see me smiling. I'm aware of that. But it's taught in so many different ways, and it's fascinating to look and see. And, I mean, calculus is one of the first things that we regularly see in life that's not obvious to us. It doesn't make sense. I mean, we can count on our fingers and add 1 to 3 and get 4 most of the time. And we can look at multiplication as repeated addition. But all of a sudden, this idea of looking at the derivatives of the mathematical representation of something and deriving something from that, that's
but,
not
But immediate. Back to the subject of libraries. That's where you started.
Yes, thank you. The idea of just what else is there? And when we go to the digital libraries, when we go to Kindle, you don't see what else is there. And yes, my fantasy and my wife's fantasy and my daughter's fantasy is the library in Beauty and the Beast. Just the, as you said, with the ladders going up the side. We have a 200-year-old Greek Revival house. And Sue and I have talked several times about making the back room into a library with adding to it, adding stories to it and bookshelves around, just because it seems so cool. So, yes, I very much agree with Mr. Sacks and Dr. Sacks on that.
I understood where he was coming from, and also it's how he grew up, and that's how he learned, and he attributed his libraries to his curiosity and this expansive world that was available to him. I would just, you know, and I think I grew up on very similar, you know, there was the library culture of it being a quiet place, a contemplative place, and, you know, oh, just loving it. And, you know, to this day, if I'm ever fortunate enough to travel, I seek out those libraries around the world, which are phenomenal, you know. Yeah. And to me, like, there's nothing better than going into somebody's home and they have bookshelves. And it's just, whether you peruse them or not, it's just a warm, wonderful feeling. So how much of that is just how I grew up and what I was used to? And, you know, that's hard. You know, these changes are hard to let go, you know. But the question of whether it's better or not, my friend, they just did a beautiful new library in Belmont. And she went into it and I said, what do you think? She goes, oh, she's my age too. As soon as you walk in, there's this wall of digital stuff. She's, I didn't see any books. Mm. It was so turned off. She goes, I know it's good. I know, you know, but also, I mean, I worked at the medical school. And again, when I started there, it was as I remembered what libraries were. Man, didn't take long because they're real lively centers, community centers now, mm-hmm. where there's discussion groups and it's open and and that's a wonderful thing, you know, if people are communicating and having a public space to do that and exchange ideas. So I love an old library. I love a room full of books. But, you know, I could concede that there's some pluses. And also, if you're going to keep people going, then all the kids you are raising, they are digitized.
Yeah.
And get in their world and get them excited. So I understand. Don't love it, but I understand.
And when you think of those shelves of medical textbooks that only get revised, what, every 10 years, every 20 years, whereas if you do it digitally, they can, whether they do, keep it up to date. You know, you can have the most cutting-edge information at your fingertips, not in an old library with books.
Well, they at UMass, this was years ago, they eliminated all their journals. Mm-hmm. It was all online. But, you know, like, you got to go find it, read the article. Then you'd go to the copier.
Take it to the photocopier. That's what I was going to say.
That's what was happening, you know, in a paperless society. So just eliminated it all.
Well, part of the good thing about old libraries, again, is if you start with the older books, you get the initial thoughts on a subject. Mm. When I try to teach somebody something about scientifically or whatever, I start at the beginning. You know, this is what we saw initially. This is what the unlearned saw. And then somebody figured out that this was the relationship. And somebody figured out something else on the top of that. And I think that's a very effective way to teach and to learn. And that you get that with old libraries, you find.
Yeah.
I remember being in junior high school, or actually freshman year of high school, and taking Latin. And they had recovered the Latin books. And this was back in the early 60s. And the books had copyright dates of 1800 something. And we made a comment to the teacher, and he said, well, you know, it hasn't changed a lot in the last 100 years.
I'm gonna turn to Carla for a minute. We just have a few minutes left, Carla, but is there anything else in your list of notes that you wanted to surprise us with?
I will talk a little bit about, if you liked this book, other books of his that you should check out. He has books that really contain just case histories. The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, Musicophilia, An Anthropologist on Mars, Awakenings. He explored the deaf culture in Seeing Voices. He went to a community of colorblind people in his book, The Island of the Colorblind. And he explored the visual brain in The Mind's Eye and Hallucinations. I brought with me his memoir. He had two memoirs, Uncle Tungsten and On the Move. The reason I brought this one is because I just had to show you
Oliver Sacks on the cover.
Oh, right.
And again, listener, let me describe for you this beefcake of a man within a leather jacket and denim that's just straining over these mighty thigh muscles as he's sitting on this motorcycle. This is Dr. Oliver Sacks, and he was a power lifter back in the day on the beaches of California. So what a life.
All of these books.
And I think what I'm most proud of Dr. Sacks for is just kind of introducing the switch from this traditional medical model of focus on deficit and fixing the deficit to a more patient-centered, person-centered approach where it's collaborative care and you are working with someone. Like, what are your priorities? And you're seeing someone as Lowell and not the Tourette person in room 215. Mm-hmm. Love that. Yes. That's my thoughts.
Yeah. I read lots of reviews of this book that were very positive, but there are, if he has had criticisms over the years, it's about whether he's right to share patient information like this. Any of you who, like me, have worked in healthcare, you know, confidentiality is drummed into us. One of his critics, and this goes back years ago, says Oliver Sacks, the man who mistook his patient for a book. But I will tell you that in my education, it was the case studies that I learned the most from.
Absolutely.
I can read the whole chapter about what Tourette's is, but describe one person to me, oh, now I get it, and now I remember it. So there's a real value to this, and I think most of the reviewers agree that he writes with great compassion about his patients, and he doesn't sensationalize it. But that's the only criticism I found about him. But generally, he's very well regarded. And on that note, I'm going to need to stop our conversation here because I want to be sure to let people know what's coming up next. I'll just remind everybody that Speaking Volumes is broadcast live on the first Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. And it's repeated on the other Tuesdays at 6 and on Wednesdays at midnight. If you'd like to get a monthly email reminder before each broadcast, please send an email to info@audiojournal.org. I screwed up the calendar a little bit here. In some places, I've printed our next books in one order, and in another place, I printed them in a different order. So one thing we're all clear on is that next month we're reading Fried Green Tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe by Fanny Flagg. I'd like to do in June, Nothing to See Here, and in July, Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland. It's those last two that I have flipped by accident, I think because they both have nothing in the title, and I just went too quickly. But volunteers and listeners who are on our email, I will send out the revised list, and poor Julie in the office, I will get her straightened out too. Fried Green Tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe centers on a cafe in the railroad town of Whistle Stop, Alabama, and on Iggy and Ruth, the two women who run the cafe. It is a wide-ranging novel. It goes from Georgia to Birmingham to Chicago and swings back and forth in time. But the core of this novel is the unusual love affair between Iggy and Ruth. We love hearing from listeners like Rachel. If you have a book you'd like to recommend, or if you just want to pass along a comment about a book, you can call the office at 508-752-0557 or email us info@audiojournal.org. Speaking Volumes has been a production of Audio Journal. Our program has been archived and can be easily accessed by visiting our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone or iPad the app's been recently updated, and it's pretty slick looking there now, so you might want to take a look at that. Thanks tonight to Tricia Droney, Steve Robsky, and Carla McCullough. My name is Carol Sarafkhan, and I want to let you know that we are looking for new books to add to our list. We, as you know, we've got the next couple lined up, but I'm always looking for suggestions to add to our schedule after that. So volunteers and listeners, let me know if you come up against a good book and you think it might make for a good discussion. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week when we talk about fried green tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe.
This is Bird Note. Poet Sidney Wade has been birding for nearly 20 years. But for even the most experienced birders, there are days when we learn something entirely unexpected. Here's Sidney with a poem about one such encounter with a double-crested cormorant.
Blue. The great blue song of the earth is sung in all the best venues, treetop, marsh, desert, shore, and on this spring day in the wetlands where, under a late sun, we stand alone and in love with each other and the passing day, we watch a cormorant whose eye is ringed in blue diamonds, a shimmering lure, and we love this blue and this dark bird and this deepening sky that pinks and hums in the west. And then the bird opens his beak and flutters his throat, and the late afternoon light illuminates the inside tissue of his mouth, which is as blue as his ocular jewelry, as blue as the bluest ocean, as blue as the sky in all its depth, as blue as the back of the small and determined beetle who struggles to roll his enormous dung ball in his own breeding bid to enchant another small blue miracle. Part of their mating plumage is they get this beautiful sapphire ring around their eye, and I had not known that the inside tissue of their beaks turns blue as well.
Find more poetry about birds at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mark Bramhill.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
What's your vision?
My vision is 20/200.
Light perception in the right eye, zero vision in the left eye.
No. What's your vision?
My goal is to become a journalist.
To be able to work.
Financial independence.
At the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, we believe that all people who are blind or visually impaired should have the opportunity to work and thrive. To learn how we can help you meet your employment or workforce goals, call 800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.
Audio Journal, the radio reading service of Central Massachusetts, serving visually and print-impaired listeners since 1987. Audio Journal is a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.